The weather did turn cold and wet enough in Oregon a while ago for the various wildland fire agencies to stand down. Fire season is over, they said, on the Oregon side. And then the sun came out and the temperatures shot back up to around 80 degrees in the Rogue Valley. When the winds blow warm, some of us are still nervous about the prospects of fire. It has been a long and destructive fire season. And it seems like we say that a lot in recent years. We have three guests with us who can help us understand what goes on in wildland fires normally and what's been observed more recently. J. Keith Gillis is the chair of the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection, the board that oversees CAL FIRE, and he's also the dean at the College of Natural Resources at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you for joining us today.
Pleased to be here.
John Bailey is with us as well. He is a professor at the School of Forestry at Oregon State University. Thank you for joining us, John.
You're very welcome.
And we have Eric Christensen with us as well, who's a retired National Fuels Program lead for the Federal Interior Department. Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
John Bailey, I want to start with you. I understand there's an annual fire summit at Oregon State University, and I can imagine these are getting possibly more interesting and maybe even better populated over the years. Tell us about that.
The planned fire summit for the spring?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we are just in the process of planning that now. The idea is to pull together the experts and the information as best we can and look at how we can influence policy. Public perception of many of these issues. And I think we'll make strides today with your listeners on bringing them up to speed on where we are with the science and thinking and projections for the future.
Is there a greater sense of urgency among the scientists who might logically attend this summit about talking about policy in addition to just what happened in this fire or that fire?
Yes, and that's the idea. And we were talking about it a little bit while we were waiting to get started that, kind of interesting that we act surprised each year as these things are coming, as these fire seasons roll around, and the fact that it's longer and it's getting worse. And yes, it's quite variable year to year and where it pops up and everything. But this fire is this type of fire is inevitable. As we look at current climate changes in the fire season, what the projections are for the near future, the accumulation of fuels on the landscape. We're entering a new world, and we need to bring society and the policymakers along with us.
And Keith Gillis, it certainly seems like this new world is arriving already in California with almost a year-round fire season. Is it actually never closed at this point anymore?
It gets better and worse, but we've definitely already moved, I think, permanently to a longer, intense fire season. There are parts of the year where it's less intense, but we're keeping parts of the state staffed up for CAL FIRE year-round at a much higher level than we've ever done historically.
I have to wonder about the size of CAL FIRE. I mean, given that you're in the most populous state and it is a big one physically, too, I mean, is it as big, bigger than the Forest Service firefighting operation?
I've never actually compared those numbers. We're certainly the largest state organization for firefighting. But that reflects the size of California and the fact that the state is the primary, agency for first response on millions and millions of acres, a much larger direct protection authority than in many state forest services. Eric might have some idea of the comparable sizes because the federal government is very large, but moves around a lot of its resources, so a state-level comparison doesn't really work there.
Sure. Eric, got any ideas about the size of the firefighting force at the federal level?
The five wildland management federal agencies typically have somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 people a year that would be funded directly out of fire management preparedness funds. And then, of course, all the other employees, or many of the other employees who are funded out of other resource programs, can be made available ultimately. So the Forest Service, BLM, Fish and Wildlife Service, BIA, National Park Service combined can probably field somewhere between 20,000 and 25,000, I would estimate, people to engage directly in fire management activities in a given year.
We have pointed out that you are recently retired from the federal government, but still get around. I understand you were on the ground at the Chetco Bar fire area not terribly long ago. Were you part of that the bear team?
No. Prior to the bear team being there, there was a Type 1 incident management team assigned to the fire to help finish up the mop-up operations and do much of the fire suppression repair work. And that team was a team that I ran with for years. They were assigned to the fire. They needed a substitute fire behavior analyst, so they called me out of retirement to help out.
So what kinds of things did you see on the ground at Jetco Bar that might have been unique, things that made this fire different from perhaps others you've seen?
Frankly, Jeffrey, I don't know that I saw anything that was different or unique.
Mm-hmm.
That's very steep country over there. You know, the Siskiyous and the Kalmiopsis Wilderness is very steep, dissected, complex terrain. Especially on the west side, it's heavily forested, primarily Douglas fir, you know, tan oak, madrone, those kinds of species. And clearly there was, you know, some wind-driven fire runs, you know, that burned the canopy, you know, virtually entirely. I understand from the Bear folks, I was looking at some of the Bear reports this morning, the Burned Area Emergency Rehabilitation, or Bear, and they reported that only about 7% of the soil in the fire area, which is about 191,000 acres, was actually burned severely. So it was, canopy is gone in many places in that fire, is what I saw. Soil damage is relatively minor for such a large, long-duration fire.
That is good to know, because we were all marveling at the map recently that showed the severity, but the fact is that the severity to the soil cannot be that great, but you still have a burned canopy. That's a very important distinction.
And that's typically, you know, how the burned area rehabilitation is discussed in two ways, effects to the soil and effects to the vegetation.
All right. Let's talk more with our panel in just a few moments here about wildfire this year, wildfire generally, and wildfire in the future. Eric Christensen is retired from the National Fuels Program for the Interior Department. John Bailey's with the School of Forestry at Oregon State University. J. Keith Gillis is the Dean of the College of Natural Resources at UC Berkeley and the Chair of the Cal Fire Board. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with our guests and load up the phone lines. Let's talk about fires and fire prevention and management. 800-838-3760, jx@jeffnet.org. Back to the exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are having a bit of a fire retrospective today. At least we hope it is retrospective and that we're not going to see much more activity in the wildlands as we go further into the winter ahead of us. But this was quite the fire season, as you're well aware. Three guests with us to help us understand what happened, what happens in most fires, and what they're seeing in the way of changes over the years. Keith Gillis is the chair of the Cal Fire Board and dean of the College of Natural Resources at the University of California, Berkeley. John Bailey is at the School of Forestry at Oregon State University. Eric Christensen is a retired National Fuels Program lead for the Interior Department. So several experts on fire behavior here. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Eric Christensen, I want to come back to you first, because you were at the Jetco Bar fire area and reported that it doesn't look terribly different or unique from anything, but you would have, I think, had to have blindfolds and ear covers on to not be aware of some of the arguments about how that fire was fought.
Yeah, and you know, not that I was there on July the 12th when it started, and I wasn't familiar with what was entirely the fire situation on that date, but typically in southwestern Oregon, there are periods of lightning that, you know, come from the southwest, from the monsoon. By the time the monsoonal moisture gets that far north, much of the moisture is gone, but lightning does hit the ground with a paucity of precipitation. Consequently, there's typically dozens, if not hundreds, of fires that can get started in a single lightning episode. I do understand that fire was attacked initially with repellers from the repel base up there in Merlin, and they were, given the circumstances, they were unable to contain it, and, you know, being so steep and... I'm not exactly sure where the fire started. As I flew over it, I couldn't pinpoint exactly the origin, but I know that all that country is just so steep, and it was heavily timbered in places, or at least were heavy surface fuels. very difficult to contain.
So, John Bailey, I want to turn this to you now, because at the core of this or any such discussion of how fires are fought, why they happen in the first place, we get into a discussion of how we manage natural resources. And I have to believe you've watched that for a long time now and probably saw the internet memes over the summer showing burned out forests and the words, "Thanks Sierra Club," or stuff like that. Are there some fundamental mistakes that people make in how they view wildfire and its causes?
Oh, I wouldn't characterize them as a mistake. You know, we're a product of how we are raised and the forces of society. And there have been very strong campaigns, Smokey Bear and others, and Walt Disney with Bambi and those kinds of things, with the notion that the fire destroys the forest and destroys the wildlife and all those kinds of things out there. And that's why I think people, you know, sense like, oh, well, we should have been able to get out on the Chetco bar and put it out right away. And it would have been a manageable risk for the firefighters to be in there and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, I think the evolution of our social perception needs to head in the direction that fire is inevitable. You already heard that the Chetco Bar fire wasn't that bad of a fire. It did a lot of fuels management for us. Yes, we could have gotten out in front of it with some prescribed burning, and that may have given us some other options. We could have gotten out in front of it with some good thinning programs and restoration management and met the wood needs of society and all those kinds of things for at least some of the areas, and that would have modified fire behavior. But, you know, that's all water under the dam at this point. But as we move forward, we need to think more about how the fire is inevitable. It's not always that bad. It can be tied to so many of our other land management objectives. And basically that when we look out at the hillsides, whether you see them as scenery or habitat or recreation opportunities or watershed protection or timber or fiber or carbon, regardless of what you see when you look up at the hills, it's all fuel as well. It's all of those things at one time, and it's also fuel, and it will burn. And so we just need a comprehensive approach to that and acknowledge that, you know, fire isn't always bad. And I'll note, yeah, we're at the end of the wildland fire season now, but it's also, this week is a great prescribed burning week. And we could be out there burning additional thousands of acres under prescription, preparing for next year's wildland fire season.
We were talking about similar discussions yesterday, more specifically about the urban wildland interface with folks from Ashland Fire Rescue. This is a city nestled in the hills, and the trees get dry. And some of the things were surprising me to learn that fire was even every 5 years on very short cycles in days before people came and settled this, European Americans came in. The fires really are that they were that much a part of the ecosystem and that frequent before settlement?
Yeah, that's our best understanding right now, and that your part of the world down there certainly gets all the lightning strikes that we were just talking about, but also the indigenous peoples for thousands of years burned the grassland essentially every other year is the best reconstruction. And then we have the oak savanna kind of conditions that maybe burned every 2 to 3 years, the pine dominated every 5, 7, 9 years. Something like that. And then, you know, as you move up in the moisture gradient and elevation gradients and all that kind of stuff, fire becomes less frequent. But anywhere that you've got ponderosa pine and Douglas fir, it burned and was burned 3, 4, 5 times a century. And that was their land management approach. It's the way these systems evolve for 10, 15,000 years. It's what they're set up to do. And we largely interrupted that 100 years ago and now have created a situation that just hasn't existed in terms of that fuels, but also our human settlements being interspersed with it. And then now we have a climate pattern that's starting to put a hurting on us.
We are talking of fires history and fires behavior now with John Bailey at the School of Forestry at Oregon State University, Eric Christensen, who used to be with the Interior Department in the National Fuels Program, and J. Keith Gillis, who is the chair of the board that oversees Cal Fire. Keith Gillis, this must be like a several degrees more difficult to have discussions about resource use in California, because you do, as John Bailey was just saying, have more people interspersed across the state generally, but certainly scattered through the wildlands around. I mean, has any sort of direction emerged other than just to make the observation that, yeah, fire season is almost year-round now, and it happens a lot?
Well, I think the whole nature of the fires we're fighting has changed tremendously, both as John's pointing out, the vegetation matrix is very different over time. We're not fighting fires that were in a vegetation matrix like they looked a century ago when they first became very active in fire suppression. The distribution of infrastructure, whether it's homes or power lines, throughout that vegetation matrix is very different. And I was trained in kind of the school of economics. I'm both a forester and an economist, the kind of the institutional school of thought. So I read a lot of the background history to understand the situations I'm doing work on. And it is fascinating to watch the evolution in California of the perception of the mission from largely protecting standing timber as a resource to thinking about, we have a much more complex mission here where we have millions and millions of people and billions of dollars of assets at risk in the wildland. And how do we simultaneously protect natural resources that have value in themselves, the ecosystem services of natural resources, as Eric was talking about? Well, what do we actually do to the soil here as opposed to timber you might sell? And then, you know, human safety and human infrastructure. So it's become a much harder problem to define what's our priority other than saying public safety has to come first in that complex management problem you're facing.
So what would you end up with trying to explain to people, well, you know, we are going to have some fire at a time when people really don't want to think about fire? I mean, you end up with that situation still, don't you?
Oh, right. Well, so as John's pointing out, these areas evolve burning, whether it's the kind of lightning strikes he was speaking about or in much of Cal Fire's protection zone. Most fire origin is human causes, whether it's human activity or it's human infrastructure. So a power line, you know, it can be a fire source. Yeah, it's different. It's going to burn. Fire is inevitable in any Mediterranean ecosystem like we are in California. The damage caused by the fire, the severity of the fire in terms of what's the impact on loss of life, on loss of infrastructure, and the resource impact, those outcomes aren't inevitable. You can actually take management actions to try and live in a way that's consistent with the natural hazards you face in the same way that you face any other natural hazard, like floodplains or earthquake faults.
Okay, I want to remind our listeners we're talking about fire season just passed, or we hope it's passed us anyway, and some general observations about that. Fire management, and a look at what we're talking about for the future here. J. Keith Gillis is the Dean of the College of Natural Resources at the University of California, Berkeley, and he is the chair of the board that oversees Cal Fire. John Bailey is at the School of Forestry at Oregon State University. Eric Christensen is the retired National Fuels Program lead for the Interior Department. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Lots of questions about fire and how we use it and how we direct it and how we manage it. 800-838-3760. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. Eric Christensen, I want to come back to you and use your knowledge of fuels generally. I mean, how different is what exists in a lot of wooded areas now from what might have been there, say, 150 years ago? Do we even know?
We have some very good ideas. As both Keith and John pointed out, in many of our Western ecosystems, the fire return interval was quite frequent. You know, typical in your ponderosa pine and Douglas fir sites, you know, as frequent as every other year. And then, you know, a little bit more frequent or less frequent in the more mixed conifer, higher elevation zones. Consequently, you know, since the dawn of fire suppression, you know, depending on how you want to count it, but the Forest Service, you know, really started in a big way following the big fires of 1910. Some people actually date organized fire suppression back to the 1870s when the Army took over Yellowstone Park. Regardless of when you start from, we have missed several fire return intervals over time in our various ecosystems, both the shrublands and the forest lands. Consequently, we have that much fuel built up in places that hasn't burned over a century or more. And if, you know, pick a 10-year average, for example, in the ponderosa pine type for a fire return interval. In a century, we've missed 10 fire cycles. Consequently, we can have as much as 10 times or one order of magnitude more fuel on the ground, roughly, than you know, what probably was there prior to Euro-American settlement.
Wow. So, and I'm wondering about the explosiveness of what's out there, too, just based on the several dry years we had, and it seems like the one wet winter didn't make much difference. I saw, Eric, this year for the first time, I noticed there are many measures for fuels, but one of them is the energy release component. What does that mean, and where does that go?
The energy release component is one of the major indexes or indices that we look at as part of the National Fire Danger Rating System, which was invented in the 70s and gives us an idea of, on both a daily and a seasonal basis, what kind of fire danger we're looking at for a given area for a given period of time. And the energy release component itself measures the fuel moisture content, specifically of the large fuels, and it gives us a real good idea of long-term chronic drought. Now, I do have right in front of me, I'm looking at the a composite ERC plot, energy release component plot for Southwest Oregon, and it looks like we were well below average for much of June. And then beginning right around the last week in June, it started to get dry. We're under a subsidence inversion, it looks like. And fire danger just continued to ramp up until it got above the 85th percentile around August 1st. And when things are that dry and we have that much fuel on the ground, we do have potentially explosive combination of factors out there in the ground. You add to it the complexity of the topography and, high fire danger, dry fuels, steep complex topography, makes for a very difficult or makes for a very explosive wildland fire situation.
So, John,
could I jump in there? For the benefit of the public that's listening, Eric, could you pick up on our host's comment about the wet year didn't seem to have a lot of effect? People really, I find, talking to California public, have some misconceptions of what a wet year actually does to fire danger.
Thanks for that, Keith, yeah.
Recognize that there are several size classes of fuels available to burn. And one of the reasons that we have, we can have wildland fires throughout the year is because the smaller size classes of fuel, the grass, the brush, and so forth, responds very rapidly to moisture. So the big wet winter and spring, for example, in California, produced a bumper crop of grasses and shrubs that then can dry out. Those grasses, a blade of grass out there, or cheatgrass in eastern Oregon, or those smaller size classes of fuel that are a quarter inch and smaller in diameter, can respond to ambient conditions in about an hour. Therefore, they can be really moist one day, and then it stops raining. The next afternoon, they could conceivably be eligible to burn. And that's what we saw in much of California, especially in the oak grass savanna, the foothills, those fires that were burning North Bay. There was a great deal of brush and grass that responded to the very wet winter and thus was eligible to burn later in the summer, early in the fall.
So, John Bailey, what do we do then? I mean, how do we prepare for what amounts to having gasoline in the landscape, waiting for lightning to strike or a car tailpipe to drag or something to provide a spark?
Yeah, it's active management. The reminder that in addition to all the other things that the forests and the rangelands are for us, that that they are also fuel, that every year does get dry. So yes, a wet winter and wet spring only delays the beginning of the fire season, but then actually makes the amount of fine fuel higher, and so that makes it a very burnable year. And then, of course, a dry winter or a dry spring, you don't have as much of the fine fuel, but the fire season starts earlier and runs longer. So either way, these things are going to happen. In this part of the world, these fires are going to happen, and it's going to include the hot, windy, Diablo wind kind of days that Northern California has seen. They come in one form or another basically every year. And our ancestors, 404,000 years ago, did not fear those winds in the coming fire season because they managed their fuels and they viewed it. So, you know, they knew it was coming. They managed their landscape knowing that it was coming and didn't live in the kind of fear that we live in of the Diablo winds now.
Can there be a pure discussion? I mean, when foresters get together, I mean, can you ever just talk about the forestry part of it without having at least an eye toward the door and the idea that politics is going to burst in at any moment?
And that is certainly the nature of the beast for the last couple decades, is that there's a lot of social resistance to the active management of the woods out there because of the kind of the failed notion of preservation. That's what I call it with my students. We went through a phase with a very strong preservation model, the idea that we could set aside a piece of land and it's favorable for something, wildlife habitat, watershed, you know, riparian protection or whatever, and we can set it aside, and that's the best thing that we can do, and that it's going to survive through time and space the way it is right now. And it just completely ignores the fact that stuff still happens out there, and we preserve pickles, but preserving pickles only works on the smallest spatial and temporal scales. Things change, and in this case, in our discussion today, it's going to burn.
All right, much more to talk about with our guests about fire behavior, fire management, forest management, and we'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange to take your phone calls and emails in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are having what we hope is a retrospective on the 2017 fire season, and that we hope it's over. And with the warm weather lately, we can never be quite sure. We have three guests with us to talk about it. J. Keith Gillis is the Dean of the College of Natural Resources at the University of California, Berkeley. He is also the chair of the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection, which oversees Cal Fire, the lead agency on wildland fire for the state. Eric Christensen is a retired National Fuels Program Lead for the Interior Department. John Bailey is with the School of Forestry at Oregon State University, and you can join the discussion by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. John Bailey, that was really intriguing what you said just now. You're teaching your students about the failed notion of preservation, so wilderness areas and late successional reserves, and do you think all those ideas are built on a shaky foundation?
Yes, just because of the limits of preservation in time and space, things change. So if we acknowledge that things are going to change, and for example, for wilderness areas, had we gone ahead and let fires continue to happen in them the way they had, then preservation would have worked. But in that particular example, we removed a keystone ecological process, but we still classified that as not influencing the wilderness. And then now we're somehow surprised that these forests have continued to move on and now do some novel things. Riparian areas is another example. If we leave all of the trees, and yes, it's shade and it's nutrients and it's habitat and it's coarse wood to fall into our streams and everything, but again, it's also fuel. And so it becomes a corridor for fire to move through the landscapes, and corridors that didn't exist before. Riparian areas used to burn.
I want to get into a discussion of fire behavior itself. And Eric Christensen, this brings us back to you. Do fires do things that
Hello?
They didn't? Yeah. Who's there?
This is Eric.
Okay, good. You're there. do fires do things they didn't used to do? Is fire behavior changing over time?
In my opinion, not really. In some cases, we have relatively low severity, rapidly moving fires in grasslands. In many other cases, in the timber, we will have severe stand replacing kinds of fires. Now that said, you pick any individual location, and that generalized statement may not be accurate. But the topography over the last several hundred thousand, if not millions of years, has not typically changed. Our fuel profile certainly has. As I mentioned previously, we probably have much more fuels in most locations than we had prior to Euro-American settlement. And now that we have, as the temperature globally continues to warm, the warmest 15 years on record have been since the beginning of the century, we have more days per year that we can have these severe fires. So the fire behavior on any given, say, slope or any given afternoon may not be appreciably different, but overall, because of the accumulation of fuels and because of the more warm days, we have more opportunity in general for rapidly spreading severe fires.
So, Keith Gillis,
every ecosystem.
Keith Gillis, I wanted to bring you in and to get your perspective on this too, because you're right in the heart of it all in California, obviously.
Well, I don't think the laws of physics have changed.
No.
They still operate the way they always have, but they're operating in a different environment. It's a place with a different fuel profile. It's a place where we have built an alternate kind of fuel matrix in the form of residences and buildings throughout the forest. So that, the physics of a fire burning through an area with homes and a closed canopy of forest above it, in a sense, that fire would have burned the same way under the same conditions for all time. But we just didn't have a lot of flammable structures underneath closed canopy forests in part of the West. So what I think has changed is we have created a situation where the frequency of large damaging fires has changed. And certainly we feel that way in California, and there are a lot of reasons for it. People moving into the wildlands, perhaps a fuel profile that has a lot more fuel in the landscape and that is homogeneous over larger areas, things like that.
And I know there are human systems, too, that get involved here, particularly in the fires that burn through the wine country. I was reading some of your comments about the issue with communication. The fact that you can't get a hold of people on landlines anymore apparently affected the potential evacuations of people in the wine country.
Yes, I think that's one of the there are two things that really impressed me about the fire service. One is the fact that I think they have the best resource sharing arrangements that you can possibly imagine for a complex system where you ask the question about how many firefighters does this agency or that agency have. In effect, it doesn't matter as much because their mutual aid is so well thought out that there is, a sharing of resources. But I'm also impressed by the fire service's ability to do self-examination after large fires and the willingness historically of some federal agencies to assist in really in-depth critical examination of all natural hazards. And in this case, one of the lessons learned, I think, is we'll have to think what is the best way for people dealing with a situation as complex as the North Bay fires. This was about as bad a situation you could throw at the fire system as you can imagine. Multiple fires starting under extremely high wind conditions. You've got four or five starts, 50 to 80 mile an hour gusts over some of the area.
And we're talking temperatures of like
technology landscape, right? And at night, on late at night on a Sunday night, and we've got some new tools that are kind of force multipliers for communications, like the alerts you sign up for to voluntarily receive notifications from local public safety officials, but those are opt-in systems. We have the fire service long ago pioneered the idea of these reverse 911 calls, but increasingly people don't have landlines, right? Neither of my daughters, who are about 30, is typical of people their age. They have cell phones. They don't bother as they move around to install a landline wherever they are at any given time. So a reverse 911 to landlines is no longer an effective way to reach everyone. If you have cell phone-based systems, then if the fire quickly degrades the capacity of the cell phone coverage in an area, then your capacity to utilize cell phone-based, sign-up systems goes down. And you have fairly blunt instrument ability to override and just send a message out to any wireless site, right, assuming you've got cell phone towers to carry the mm-hmm. signal, that can't be targeted. And so I think we're going to have to look at all of those. And just people's awareness, thank goodness, is high. I can't begin to estimate how many lives were saved in the North Bay by the simple expedient of neighbors going in, pounding on their neighbor's door.
Wow.
So sometimes it's just that sneaker net of notice that really comes down to the difference between life and death.
Right. People putting on their sneakers and going next door. It worked in a lot of cases. Let's take a call here. We have John and Vanita. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Keith Gillis, John Bailey, and Eric Christensen.
Thank you, Jeff, so much for this and your guests. It's something that's really important to me and my view of the world. I'm an old hell attacker and fifth generation Oregonian and old loggers and all that. And that's my life. And I see what's going on, and one of the guests touched on I think the term he used was active management. And then you cut to a break. But I've called and just probably tired of hearing it, but these reprod units and this stuff that's been put back. Okay, once, you know, I only use the term virgin timber. I don't use this old growth thing. That's nebulous. But once it's cut down, it's not going to be virgin timber again. And the people need to realize that that needs to be managed. And we've got so many, I'll just call them thickets. And them trees stunt, get sick, they blister, and they become a fire bomb in late July and through September till the rain. Mm. And when they start, all you do is run. And we need to get real with that. And then also Christmas tree plots were the bottom dropped out of the market years ago, and people just ignored them and let them go. And there was no requirement for them to do something with it. And then they just sit there and they become dog hair, we used to call it. And it's just a bomb. And I just wanted to kind of interject that. And thanks for putting up with me.
Okay, thanks for that, John. I appreciate that. So, John Bailey, the idea that once you've touched the forest, you're going to have to touch it a lot more. And that was the heart of what John was talking about. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And that's really what I mean by active management. And it that's not a single thing. You know, we can't log our way out of this, or we can't thin our way out of this. I mean, it's going to take area appropriate ways to manage the land, manage them as fuels. And it's going to require a lot more prescribed fire than we are currently allowed to do.
Wolfgang in Sunny Valley sent an email. He writes, "The dispute between log, don't log would not exist if the politics around natural resources were not riddled with unacknowledged greed. When the logging proponents refer to natural fires, they omit to mention that natural fires in past millennia didn't clear cut, and so on. I believe the discussion on all sides ultimately lacks sincerity." And that's from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. So let me ask the question. I mean, this becomes so political so quickly. How do you move forward with one group of people who believes that the other side wants the woods to be locked up and wants them to burn, and the other side believes that their opponents want to take every stick of wood out of the woods? John Bailey?
Yeah, that is the dilemma. And see, so right now, when folks have come to the table, metaphorically, to debate these things on the social stage, folks have just been on completely different missions. And there's been the mission to preserve the forest, or it's been the mission to maximize your dollars. And what these fire seasons hopefully will do for us, it'll get us more on the same mission. And once we're on the same mission, we can work across ownerships, we can work across our social divides, and get things done. Because when these fires start and it's 2:00 in the morning and we're trying to save houses and trying to save hillsides and all that kind of stuff, we cooperate just fine. Even if we haven't slept for 2 days, we cooperate just fine. But that's because we're on the same mission. And so we certainly can sit down now in the winter season with a cup of coffee and cooperate if we're on the same mission.
Eric Christensen, do you see people getting on the same mission?
Yes and no, certainly. A lot of it depends on the individual mindsets in various localities and so forth. But in general, that's what things like the National Forest Management Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, for us feds, tries to help us to do, is learn what, affected individuals and communities and so forth are interested in. The outreach that we perform, the request for input and so forth, that's our efforts to try to get on that same social page, if you would. And, of course, all the other, as both John and Keith have mentioned, you know, the mutual aid, the interaction that's done, that happens quite a bit. But there's always going to be that fundamental divide, I think, among various individuals, you know, those who want us to actively manage and those who prefer we don't. And it's always, you know, going to have to be resolved at the local, individual, project, community level.
And Keith Gillis, as you see things like projects in communities that get blocked, for example, by lawsuits because it's a timber project, and then there become, you know, efforts in Congress to bypass lawsuits, stuff like that. I mean, is there, I guess if anybody had a way out of this, we would have found it by now. But does it intrigue you consistently, the twists and turns we go through trying to find an answer?
Well, I think we're always working on finding an answer. I mean, we have a wide range of philosophical orientations in the population, and they all have value and they all need to be respected. I think the role of the three people you have as guests here is partly to try and foster a less heated and rational dialogue there. And it's more complex even than cut, don't cut, is it corporate greed? You know, it gets into some pretty subtle points of national environmental policy. An example would be, you know, regardless of what we're hearing out of Washington, we have to have a carbon policy that makes sense. And a carbon policy relying on forests to sequester carbon, and a fire policy that says let's live with the ecology of the area in which we're embedded, are at times going to be in complete conflict.
Mm-hmm. Okay, lots of stuff.
And so we need to have a rational dialogue on that. And I think a lot of us in agencies and academia are trying to foster that kind of dialogue.
Okay, I appreciate the sense of hopefulness that you bear. Keith Gillis is the chair of the Cal Fire Board, dean of the College of Natural Resources at UC Berkeley. John Bailey's at the School of Forestry at Oregon State University. Eric Christensen is retired from the Interior Department. Thank you all for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Great pleasure to be on.
All right, take care.
Thank you for having me.